What do you do if you want to blow the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, but you know that if you do, your life will change forever? What do you do if blowing the whistle might put you in physical danger? Or what if blowing the whistle might land you in prison? You try to do it anonymously. Sometimes that works. The whistleblowers who brought us the Panama Papers, for example, are still unknown. But others who tried to remain anonymous, like drone whistleblower Daniel Hale and NSA whistleblower Reality Winner, had their anonymity compromised, and they both ended up in prison. I'm John Kiriakou. You're watching The Whistleblowers. Blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety is something that every country should celebrate. Many countries have some sort of whistleblower protection law, even in national security, but those laws are rarely enforced fairly or equally. Sometimes they're ignored altogether. And sometimes national security trumps whistleblowing, even when the whistleblower is exposing a crime. We're joined by an attorney who is not only a hero to national security whistleblowers here in the United States, but she's a whistleblower herself. She tried to remain anonymous, and she was outed, and her life has never been the same. Welcome to the show, Jesselyn Radak.
Thank you, John.
Jess, you were a senior attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice working in legal ethics. Your job was to make sure that the Justice Department's attorneys acted within the law and within the guidelines of professional responsibility. But then the September 11th attacks occurred, and many people in government decided that day that the rules would go out the window. You were not one of those people. Soon after those attacks, you found yourself involved in the case of John Walker Lind, who became known as the American Taliban. And it was soon after that that you became a whistleblower. Tell us how that happened.
It happened because I was in the ethics office, and part of my job was to give advice to attorneys prospectively. And that included not just attorneys, but FBI agents on the ground. And we got the news that they had captured a terrorist and that he happened to be American. So commensurate with any advice I would give anyone in that situation, I said that they should Mirandize him. And that apparently at that point, there are pictures circulating around the world of him being tortured, of him naked, blindfolded, bound, gagged, and held in basically a coffin. And I advised that we don't torture people and that those images are unacceptable. And certainly any information they obtain as a result of him being kept in that kind of captivity would not be admissible in court. So that was the advice I gave. I gave that in writing. but then I got a call back. That was on a Friday. I got a call back on Monday saying, oops, well, you know, we went ahead and interrogated him anyway. What do we do now? And I explained, you know, not to worry. You can still use that information for national security and intelligence gathering purposes, but not for criminal prosecution. Then they shortly thereafter used it for exactly that, to criminally prosecute him. That, you know, I found out about inadvertently when I learned that there was a discovery order for all internal Justice Department correspondence related to John Walker Lind. So I went to check the file, because back then we had paper files. Mm-hmm. And the advice I had given was missing from the file.
Right.
I happen to be apparently more computer savvy than some of my superiors. So I went and called tech support and was able to go through the computer archives. The internet at this point, we're talking 2001, is a new thing.
That's right.
Especially for the government, which is behind the eight ball on technology. So I was able to resurrect the missing email and provide it to my boss. And I said, I don't know why this was not turned over in discovery, but here it is.
And then what happened? Because you ended up being in touch with quite a prominent journalist, and that's really where your problems began.
That's correct. Basically, when I learned that the document had still not been turned over to the court, I ended up resigning, and I took home a copy of the document in case it disappeared from the file again. And when the government was continuing to pursue this case and it was evident that this information had not been turned over consistent with Brady and Giglio obligations, I ended up sharing it with a member of the press. I tried to do so anonymously. Mm-hmm. I think most whistleblowers blow the whistle anonymously. This is not about them. They want people to focus on what they're blowing the whistle on, right, not on them. Unfortunately, because it was the beginning of the internet age, while Newsweek shielded my name from the print edition, my name appeared in the digital version. And that was the beginning of the unleashing of one of the first criminal leak investigations in modern time.
When you were outed as the source in this case, your life changed. You were forced to leave a job that you loved. Many of your colleagues and friends turned against you and you had trouble finding work. Here you were, a renowned attorney. You had graduated from Brown and Yale universities, two of the top schools in the world, and you were having trouble finding a job. You finally found one at a large law firm in Washington, D.C., but it didn't last long. What happened there?
At that point, the government contacted my private third-party employer and told them that they had just hired a criminal, though I had not been charged with anything. I had not received a subject or target letter.
My God.
The law firm, of course, knew that I would have a claim against them if they just fired me, especially for being a whistleblower. So they put me on unpaid administrative leave, which left me kind of hanging in limbo for a number of months. And in the meantime, I had to lawyer up and get a criminal defense attorney, an employment attorney, and a constitutional law attorney.
Oh my gosh. And then fallout continued, actually. You had trouble when you traveled internationally. Complaints against you were lodged with the local bar association, but you ended up taking the bull by the horns and you went to work with the Government Accountability Project as their director of national security, representing whistleblowers in national security. In fact, I'm proud to say that you were one of my attorneys, and you represented also NSA whistleblower Tom Drake and even Ed Snowden. What made you decide to take on the national security establishment?
My experience of how I was treated as a whistleblower, I thought if they can come down with the full force of the entire executive branch on a public servant who had been a public servant for a long time because they were just doing their job and trying to do it honestly. It made me, I didn't know what a whistleblower was. I had the same reaction most whistleblowers do when my attorney said, "You're a whistleblower." I said, "No, I'm not. I was just trying to do my job."
Right.
But after what I went through, the fact that the government ended up putting me under a criminal investigation and referring me to the state bars and literally started a whisper campaign in my law firm, which ended up somehow following me even to my own synagogue, I realized how draconian the government can be, how brutal and underhanded, but also completely over the top. I was a mom. I had two young kids. I was pregnant during part of this ordeal. I mean, no public servant, no human, period, deserves that. Criminal defendants often have more rights than whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm. And they never charged you with a crime. And
they never charged me with a crime. And in fact, the bar complaints, it took 12 years before those charges were finally dismissed by the bar. But it was a cloud. It's a sort of Damocles hanging over your head to have to tell any potential employer, I've been referred to the bar, but based on a secret report that I've never seen and don't have access to.
You now had something called the Whistleblower and Source Protection Group. It's a part of Exposed Facts. Tell us about the kind of work that you do there.
We represent national security and intelligence whistleblowers, mainly blowing the whistle on human rights violations. So that can include the gamut of torture, secret surveillance, drone killings, and that's been an entire kind of boutique that we have focused on. We want to protect disclosures that are in the public interest, and unfortunately, a trend that started during your era of using the Espionage Act, which is an incredibly draconian law, to go after whistleblowers has unfortunately become normalized and been used primarily on whistleblowers from the FBI, the CIA, NSA, the powerhouse agencies that run this country's most significant programs.
And in fact, sentences have been getting noticeably longer, have they not?
They have. They have. Reality Winner's sentence of about 5 years was twice the normal 2.5 years that people had been given. And Daniel Hale, even his sentence of 45 months, I mean, that was for one count. One count under the Espionage Act. So the sentences, I mean, that's part of the reason they use the Espionage Act, because it is so punitive. And one count can carry, 10 years. So
we're going to talk about Daniel Hale again in a minute. But before we go to break, I wanted to ask you one other question. One of the things that I've noticed that they've been doing with whistleblowers is putting them in higher and higher security prisons. Stephen Kim, the State Department whistleblower, was in a minimum security work camp. I was in a low security prison. But Daniel Hale is in a maximum security penitentiary. Is that just because they can? Is that just to make the time that people like Daniel Hale are serving as difficult as possible?
It is unclear why Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, because there are only two in the country, and they were created to house terrorists. And Daniel had no prior criminal history. He was not convicted or charged with an act of terrorism. It is unclear how or why he ended up there. But it was alarming, certainly, to us as his attorneys, because his judge had recommended a specific prison that would have been much lower security and where he could have gotten the therapy that he needed.
Right. It's not just that he drives over to prison and turns on the TV and makes himself comfortable. He was due psychological counseling, drug and alcohol counseling, which would have shortened his sentence. Thank you, Jesselyn Radack. But don't go away. We're going to continue our conversation with Jesselyn Radack right after this short break. Stay tuned.
Nismo imali oružje, nismo spremali neki oružani napad. Mislili smo da to od komšija ne treba ništa da dođe, neko zlo.
Tako jednu večer došli su crnokošuljaši. Jedan po jedan je uzio i mijenjao se na mene, njih osmorica.
Ostao sam u toj kući sve vrijeme dok nisu pobili sve nas, sve stanovnike tog mog sela.
Robljeni Srbi. I dođe jedan muđahedin i odsječe jednom Srbinu glavu. I onda svim ostalim koji su tu, prinosi tu glavu i kaže ljubi brata. I svaki taj Srbin mora tu odsječenu glavu, dakle, da poljubi pod prijetnjom da će, naravno.
Strane Nasera Orića i većina njih izginula je na svojim kućnim pragovima, slijepo vjerujući u tada skoro izmaklo bratstvo i jedinstvo.
Look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
robot must protect its own existence.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. We're joined once again by esteemed whistleblower attorney Jesselyn Radek. Jess, it seems like we've seen so many whistleblowers who have wanted to remain anonymous, who've tried to remain anonymous, but their identities invariably are revealed. And the consequences have been drastic for many of them. The FBI whistleblower, Terry Albury, for example, received 4 years in prison. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale, we mentioned a moment ago, received 3 years and 9 months. An SA whistleblower, Reality Winner, received more than 5 years in prison. CIA whistleblower Joshua Schulte faces as much as 80 years in prison. Is there a safe way to blow the whistle? Can somebody in national security do it without being caught and then being sent to prison?
It's incredibly difficult. Even when you go through proper channels, a lot of the people you mentioned did try to go through channels at one level or another. But even with successful whistleblowers, even like the White House whistleblower on Trump, they still went through the proper channels and still got tangled up in internal channels. I mean, is there a safe way? In theory, there is. In practice, there are a lot more ways to leak these days, but there are a lot more ways to get caught. Mm-hmm. And whistleblowers are not, you're not assumed to be expert at spycraft and keeping your contact with a reporter secret. That's really incumbent upon journalists, especially the ones that hold themselves out as being all about source protection. And basic mistakes were made in a number of the cases you mentioned, whether the journalist was just being careless mm-hmm. or whether there was a snafu in the way a document got transmitted. It's very easy to get caught these days. It's almost like we're back to the days of meeting in the underground parking garage, right, where you meet in person, pay in cash, you know, and try to do it very out of the sight of cameras. But there are cameras everywhere, including yeah. in parking lots.
It's true. And an ongoing theme, too, especially with national security whistleblowers, is that identifying information is almost always embedded in documents. So if you work for one of the national security agencies and you print a document, your name and your personnel number are embedded somewhere on that document, in a period, in the dot of an I. And so if the document finds its way to the media and then the media sends it back to the agency to ask about whether or not it's a legitimate document, you've just outed yourself, or the journalist has outed you.
Right, that's correct. A lot of people have been caught basically by metadata. So not the actual document itself, but something, like you said, a marking on the document, a watermark, mm-hmm. something that's imperceptible to most people. Like in Reality Winner's case, instead of showing a Xerox copy of a document to the government, they showed the actual document so they could immediately identify right. where she, the Air Force Base, where she, this had occurred. And immediately it was a bright red arrow pointing to her. Jeff Sterling, that was another case based on metadata. I think it's easy now. It's very hard not to leave digital footprints, even when you're using mm-hmm. Encryption. I would advise any whistleblower to use Signal or to get well-versed in encryption, but you can't expect a whistleblower to have to be well-versed in security protocol to be able to
That's
get
right.
the truth out.
And you raise an important point, too. People ask me all the time, should I be using Signal? Should I be using WhatsApp or Viber? I've always been told that Signal is the best, but Signal's not perfect
no.
either. Tom Drake, the NSA whistleblower, told me recently that even with Signal, they can intercept the message before you hit send. They can intercept it as you're typing it because it's not yet encrypted. It only becomes encrypted when you send, when you hit that send button.
That's exactly right. The endpoints are the dangerous points. It may, and again, it, people think that it's the content of messages that ends up basically pointing a finger at the whistleblower, but it's not. It's the who's sending it, who's receiving it and when. That's what is getting people convicted, not the content of what they're actually saying.
Jess, we've seen whistleblowers in banking or in the legal profession who have been able to maintain their anonymity. I mentioned the Panama Papers whistleblower earlier in the show. They were very careful where they sent their information. The outlets involved protected their identities, but that hasn't been the case for national security whistleblowers. Why do you think that is? Are counterintelligence agencies really that good?
I think in Panama Papers, other cases that have more of an international dimension, it's probably easier to not be living in a surveillance state, which is where the United States has been trending. Again, people are being caught on metadata. It would be impossible for me to take the metro and come here without leaving a huge trail of metadata with buying a ticket, taking the exact train that I took here, walking with the camera on every corner. So it's easier to get caught if you're in a surveillance state that has so much monitoring going on. I think also traditionally people who are in the banking arena, including in the US, they have protections under Dodd-Frank and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the False Claims Act and a whole bunch of other protections that national security and intelligence whistleblowers do not have in this country. There is a specific carve out for national security and intelligence employees. So not only, I mean, they have a statement in the ICWPA saying that they're protected, but there's no enforcement mechanism.
Right.
So you can blow the whistle, but then when the government retaliates against you and comes down on you like a ton of bricks, you have no recourse. There is nothing you can do. And in fact, they will now prosecute you, whereas before you may have gotten an administrative wrist slap or fired or even blackballed from the industry. Now you will go to jail.
When I was at the CIA, I sat next to a woman who was having an affair with someone working for CNN who had been a senior CIA officer. And in the course of pillow talk, she revealed some classified information to him. He used that classified information in his commentary on the air on CNN. And sure enough, the CIA's Office of Security did an investigation. They immediately figured out that it was her, but they didn't arrest her. They didn't charge her with espionage. What they did is they suspended her without pay for 6 weeks. They put a letter in her personnel file and she was ineligible for promotion for a year. And that was it. Now, if that were to take place today, she would be charged with espionage and would be looking at least 5 years in prison.
That's correct. And then there's a whole range of other subtle but career-killing retaliatory mechanisms, like taking away people's security clearances.
Sure.
So even if they're still free walking around, they can't find a job in the profession they've been trained in because they can't get a security clearance renewed. So there are these subtle ways, and there's no way to contest that. There's no way to say, you're mistaken. This person is not a security risk. What they blew the whistle on was validated by Congress, and they still can't get a security clearance.
Yep. You're exactly right. You mentioned metadata a moment ago. One of the things that I fear, and tell me if this is a legitimate fear, is that when the government or individual companies, private companies, like the big information companies, Apple and Google and Yahoo and whatnot, when they collect this metadata, they have the capacity to save it forever. Is that correct? And then the FBI or the CIA or NSA can go back and draw on this information whenever it suits them.
That's my understanding. I mean, that was an issue with the data retention facility in Utah that Bill Binney had talked about. Apple, I know, has actually pushed back and said, you need a warrant if you want data. But then if the government can get a warrant, they will turn over the data. Other companies like Facebook and Twitter, I am not sure the current policy that they have in place in terms of when they will turn over data or not. But I think people do not give it a second thought when they're entering all their personal information willy-nilly into Facebook. You're making the government's case for them. It doesn't matter if you don't think you're doing anything wrong or, you know, I'm not doing anything wrong. They wouldn't be interested in me. But
right.
It's awfully easy, as you know, to construct a circumstantial case around things that actually were meant to be innocuous.
Yeah. I actually said those words. They wouldn't be interested in me, and they were very interested in me. You know, one of the questions that I'm asked very frequently is if I would do anything differently if I were to blow the whistle again. And my answer is the same every time. The answer is yes. What I would do differently is to hire an attorney before blowing the whistle. That was a mistake that I made because I was forced to be reactive rather than proactive. What advice would you give whistleblowers considering blowing the whistle?
Yeah, I would. That's exactly what I would tell them. Talk to an attorney ahead of time so they can safely walk you through these landmines. Also, you need to make a considered determination about whether or not to tell your family what you're doing and how much to tell them. I had not told my family at the time because I wanted them to have plausible deniability that they didn't know I was blowing the whistle. But at the same time, that can end up causing a rift when suddenly you have FBI agents working on your case. So there are a number of considerations. I think it's always wise to talk to an attorney. Unfortunately, 90% of people who come in my door, you know, they come in after the fact, after they've blown the whistle and they are being retaliated against.
Yep. That is exactly what my situation was. That's how you and I met.
Yes.
That's all we have for you today. Thanks to our guest, Jesselyn Radack. I'm John Kiriakou, and this has been The Whistleblowers.